Any comment or reflection or questions from the floor? Joe?
You're getting all the speakers up.
Yes. Yeah. Peter and Simon and David.
Hello. I suppose really the first comment is by way of a question, really, in a way, because I'm quite intrigued by Peter's comment about dropping or coming off the bus at stage D of the plan of work. If we believe, as I do, that the architecture is the art and science of building, does that mean that the science is dropped at stage D? That's the first question. The second one is Simon's first photograph, I think, was Harold Shipman, and this is a bit facetious. If he took the Hippocratic oath, does the panel think that the architect should do something similar?
Shall I take the first point? The point I was making was that some government departments are procuring their buildings that way, and some clients, some private sector clients, are procuring the buildings through commissioning the architect for the first stage to, say, achieve planning consent, and then saying, thank you, you'll now take your chances under a contractor-led consortium. So I wasn't saying that that's the right way to go, but I was saying that so many procurement, if it doesn't start off with a contractor-led consortium, will commission the architect to only do a portion of the work. So it's still a challenge.
Should stage D then represent perhaps 50% of the fee?
No.
And why not? Because you presumably have to go into the science part of it to properly brief your contractor who's novated. No?
No.
No.
On the Hippocratic Oath question, essentially all professions in the construction industry do have codes of ethics. So there is, and you know, as since we have the ARB as well as our various institutes, we have two sets. They're not particularly onerous. I think they should be greatly more onerous, that we should sign up to do no harm, amongst other things. The institutes tend to say that they would lose members if we did that, that we've got to live in the real world, all those sort of things. But unless the institutes actually decide that their members are a whole lot better than other people who are not members, who are perfectly entitled in this country to design buildings and design other things, then we've got really no differentiator to say that we will behave that much better. So I would actually prefer to have half the number of members of institutes, whatever pain that might give the finances of institutes, and to make them a lot tougher to be in, because we do actually sign up to something that is tough to deliver.
Hi, I'm Joan McCoy, Julian's boss. My question, or it's a sort of an observation, there's a lot of very good work has been done, particularly through this RIAS, and I've read the report on the procurement, and it was just something that Michelle had said about the government not understanding what the problem is, and there's an awful lot of definition that's been used about architectural practices and SMEs. Most architectural practices in the UK, no matter how big they are, including Brenton's huge practice, is an SME. And the challenge for Michelle's practice is much different for the challenge for Brenton's practice. And I'm worried that the government and the people who don't understand the challenges reading the reports will go, well, we'll sort it out for SMEs, so it sorts it out for 250 practices, or practices with 250 people, but doesn't sort it out for practices with 1 to 5.
I think one of the things that we tried to do when we were writing the report
was make sure that every time it mentioned SME, that was also partnered with the word micro, because that was a recognition of the ecology of the profession. The other thing that we did say was appropriateness, you know, and in terms of scale and so on. And it really depends on what is actually needed, you know. And I think that comes into exactly the point that you were saying about the language. Last October, I spoke at the Scottish Government's procurement conference, and I think to some extent I was a bit of an alien who had landed in another world. The language was totally different, and I think we have to become accustomed to that language and actually operate within that language to actually get our ideas across. Because when you actually tune in to what they're actually worried about, there are many things that we are believing in that are very valid in terms of the manner in which they are actually thinking. So we have to communicate in a particular way.
The big task is educating politicians. That's what we've got to do. We don't have politicians who are actively engaged, who really have a sensitivity or understanding. Michelle talked about having architects in any number of places, some of them in positions of power. We don't have enough of them in politics, clearly. And we don't have enough. We awarded past President Maragai because essentially he was a politician who, you know, became the architect of the change in Barcelona through the empowerment of architects. And we thought, right, if we celebrate that and we show the Scottish Government what he's done and what he's delivered, we'll be able to get it somehow into their psyche. Well, I don't think that actually happened. That was a sort of ambition. But we just have to keep going with that sort of stuff. Ultimately, you know, Mayor Bloomberg in New York at the moment is doing a fantastic job in terms of proportionate procurement. Practices of up to 10 individuals are given access to projects of up to £10 million equivalent. So essentially, that's New York, which we might see as the sort of, you know, epicenter of mammon, coming from the top level in terms of its public procurement, not looking for lowest price, actually looking for highest quality, and even determining that if you've got more than 10 qualified architects, sorry guys, you're too big to handle these jobs, you get the next stage of jobs. I mean, that's incredibly intelligent political thinking. But there are too few politicians who are actually savvy enough to realise that if they really want immortality, then they ought to be looking to the architectural profession to give it them. And once we can persuade them of that fact, then things will improve.
What we've done, in what we're attempting to do in the process of doing, is trying to benchmark architects so that it's clear how many architects in a practice will generate whatever level of turnover. So at least when they're asking for turnover, of you know the ridiculous turnovers that they ask for, that they know what that means. And then we give them also the number of practices with those number of people so that they can see, well, actually there aren't any in Ireland, you know, which is normal. That's a normal response. And also we have tried to do, there's no silver bullet on procurement. It's 10 different approaches. Every approach has to be used. The way we're trying to approach it, because we've gone through the whole process with lawyers trying to get around the system or change it or get legal advice on why their particular procurement methods are dangerous in terms of public purse money. It hasn't worked because the more lawyers you get involved in something, the more and more complex it gets. So we've pulled away from lawyers and we are doing it as architects, because actually architects, as David has pointed out clearly, are well able to deal with any of these kind of systems and can think laterally about anything. So what we're trying to do is put a procurement system together, and we're gradually trying to introduce it in various places so that it's not news and rejected immediately, because it takes a few goes at a new idea for somebody to sort of even start thinking about it in an acceptable way. So that's how
we'll give you our report in Word, because that's what CABE's done. Essentially, they've taken our report and they've CABE-ized it. So I don't know what the equivalent of kilting we refer to kilting of documents, as in Scotticising them. So if you want to RIAI, you're more than welcome. We will give you it to manipulate.
And I think it would be fair to say that we are having some impact. Alex Neil, the Minister for Infrastructure, announced on the 7th of February that there is now a review into construction procurement. And we would have to hope that our efforts have helped in that. I think the other thing is you look at, someone mentioned the Treasury earlier on, and HM Treasury guidance note number 3 on the selection of design teams basically lays out your formula. You know, the point one has an enormous impact on the 80. And they actually say that procurement has to be dealt with incredibly carefully and that cheapest isn't best. And that's HM Treasury saying that. We really have to push that message.
Brilliant. I'd like to move on.
Can I just say just something on that? There is a warning here that shares can go up as well as down, or down as well as up. And I think certainly in England, we have seen government very keen, mainly through CABE, promoting the idea that design offers value, and with the new government coming in and saying they don't want value, they want ordinary and no better, and they want it as cheaply as possible. And the word cheap is now in government guidance. Unfortunately, the Treasury document, like all documents that preceded the current government in the UK, is seen as being archaic.
We've got to persuade them that it's not about cheap, it's about cost-benefit. It's about building in the long-term cost-benefit, best value in the long-term, which ultimately is cheap by another definition. But if you build in good value in the long-term and you actually build in fundamental human values, within our report, there is a really telling, it's very difficult to get empirical evidence that demonstrates that improvements in aesthetic quality and the human values that all architects want to create and build into their buildings actually give you direct economic benefits. We had, if you like, a sort of almost an experimental process that had occurred, in a sense by chance, through a medical facility in Fife for people with severe long-term disability, dementia, long-term neurodegenerative disease. Essentially, they'd previously been looked after in a sort of ward-like situation. And a very bright project manager within the Fife health team brought in some very good architects, and they created spaces that are homey, small scale, broken up, good views, nice courtyards with fountains and gardens and all that sort of sensory stuff that all of you in this room would know intuitively is what you should be doing. That demonstrably reduces chemical caution, and that's quantifiable. You can say that's X million pounds because you're reducing the drugs budget. It reduces the cost of having to have staff there to hold people down where they're kicking and screaming and in anguish and biting and fighting. Now, in my view, those two goals are quite sufficient of themselves. But to persuade the politicians, you say those two goals are achieved, plus a saving over the term of £10 million. All of a sudden, you've actually got an economic benefit that is proven, and an experiment, if you like, that demonstrates that building in quality gives you long-term cost benefits, very significant long-term cost benefits. To hell with the human benefits. Who cares about, you know, how well we educate kids in lively environments rather than just sheds? But actually, if you can say, if you educate kids in lively environments, you'll get a better educational return, then you actually start really winning the argument with the politicians.
Thank you. Somebody's mobile's buzzing away there. Stephanie.
Yeah, my question is for David. You said that you received criticism from other architects for your WikiHouse project.
Yeah.
It kind of follows on from what Simon said about society not having much trust in architects. Would you say that you don't have much trust in the other architects that criticised you, or would you say that's not really fair?
I think it's probably a natural fear. There's quite a human response when your sort of livelihood appears threatened, but that's quite knee-jerk, isn't it? If you logically think it through, as we've tried to do, I don't think it threatens any of our livelihoods. And so, no, I would criticise more the sort of the idea that we want to withhold knowledge. Yes, there's a lot of money making based on proprietary knowledge, but I say denying others the benefit of knowledge is not a very professional act, I would say. If we're really genuinely and being kind of sincerely interested in sustainability, the world, society, whatever, you're looking to actually disseminate. So my only criticism is sort of if the counterposition to us sharing information is someone advocating no, harbour it for self-interest.
My name is Declan Hill from the Forum for Alternative Belfast. I'm an architect. David might like to assist in answering this question, but basically my question is directed at Neil. In April 2003, in Scotland, the Scottish Parliament instructed local authorities and basically introduced local community planning. Now that hasn't been introduced yet here in the north of Ireland, but it will be in about 2015. You know, like most things, we're always a little bit behind here, but we can certainly learn maybe from your experience. And I just wondered how that has affected the role of the architect.
Well, the current system of community planning actually replaces a system that I felt was much better. So the frustration is we now have bigger communities wherein community plans operate. Before that, they were smaller. So I don't know what the numbers were, but in Glasgow, they reduced 20 down to, say, 4. Now, the 20 with local management, you know, were cost intensive, but they were doing an incredibly good job. The 4 do a less good job. And, you know, I still think they're very valid because they're actually about creating catalyst mechanisms within their local communities. And, you know, that's quite an effective, you know, obviously the local authority across the whole piece has its huge scale of responsibilities. And by narrowing into more localized management systems and actually having more dynamic management systems that are much more responsive, you actually get better outturns, and they can focus on community development projects that do work in the main. I think they'd all be provable to work.
I attended a community planning event actually as a community councillor up in Aberdeen, and I must admit, from that perspective, it left me utterly cold, because it seemed to be having absolutely no impact whatsoever, and it was just a bureaucratic process. Nice word, nice phrase, but it didn't actually get a group of like-minded people together who wanted to make a difference. It was very high-bound by idiots going on about points of order and nonsense like that. It was just small town politics.
My experience is actually focused in Glasgow, where things tend to work. I can see that they might not work in Aberdeen, but I don't have such local experience in Aberdeen, I'm afraid. We still have countless problems, as you can tell, across Scotland, and actually some things that work really well. I mean, it's actually true that, you know, we've got pre-planning processes that work brilliantly in some places and are a disaster in others. So, you know, across the piece, you've got peaks and troughs.
The challenge is, who the hell is this community? In a small, isolated rural settlement, well, you can say it's probably a resident constituency. In most urbanised settlements, it's the constituency. I could be one of 10 different definitions of a community. I don't need to live somewhere to participate in the making of the place. So I think the big challenge is about actually working out this community planning. Well, where's the mandate? Which community are you planning for? And I think the stepping back of local authority away from an arbitration is a real problem. We met with the Grant Shapps, his chief of staff, pre-election. It wasn't foresight we knew going to win, but actually went to them to talk about our right to build proposal about actually empowering people with housing. It seemed to have been sort of, say, plagiarised to a degree to get the community right to build in the UK, which is part of the localism agenda. But still, where does that mandate? What kind of local referendum? And who's identifying the community is a big challenge, but I wouldn't walk away from it because I think we need this empowered sort of citizenry. But, as I say, somehow arbitrated, somehow kind of enabled, kind of measured, balanced, representative, which is a huge challenge, but that's the nature of the societies we live in now. And if we kind of give up and say that's an impossible challenge, well, we're back to kind of some form of centralised, imposed control. So, yeah, I think for me it just comes back to it's nice, but how do we kind of really constitute community?
Any other questions or observations? Yes, Jane.
Question for Neil. I think our two main problems here are procurement and promotion. And I see that you have PR as one of the items which you are in charge of. I'm just wondering how you would suggest that we promote architecture more here in Northern Ireland.
I have the good fortune. I didn't face up at the beginning of all of this, folks, so now I confess I have to come out here. I'm not an architect. Horrible. But I've always been a sort of architectural groupie, and if you want to talk to me about why, I can explain that later. I've actually never wanted to be an architect, but my background includes a large dollop of PR. My own consultancy was PR, marketing and events, and mainly around architecture for about 20 years before I came into the RIS post. Public relations, it requires, you're very, very lucky if you can find public relations consultants who can genuinely do it without ripping you off at massive cost. And I say that as a member of the Chartered Institute of Public Relations. So if you tweet that, I will kill you because I will immediately be struck off. But it is the case that there are far too many people who swan around looking glamorous and pretending to be public relations consultants, and they're no bloody good. And, of course, none of them are members of the Chartered Institute of Public Relations. I should hasten to add that. Public relations, crucially important. It requires a lot of guile. We recently did a quantification in the RIS. We've had, before I arrived, my depute, who's a former journalist, and so am I, and I did an assessment of the three organisations within the Scottish architectural firmament: Architecture and Design Scotland, the then Lighthouse, which has more or less imploded since, and the Incorporation. The Incorporation had, in the 6 months prior to our joint arrival, achieved nothing in terms of public relations hits, if you like. The Lighthouse had achieved many because it was at that stage imploding, so it was all bad news. And A&DS had achieved good coverage from the fact that its chief executive was cycling backwards for charity. So effectively, we felt that if you have to be a complete prat to get public relations, then I'm not signing up for that. But don't tweet that either, because I think that's defamatory. But essentially, since then, we engender maybe about 200 to 300 pieces a quarter. And that's very strategic, it's very focused. Essentially, everything we do that is pressworthy, and it's about knowing what the stories are, is put out there as a story. And it's a very simple mechanism. You write it down intelligently and briefly, and you punt it out to the journalist. Hopefully, if it's architecture with a lovely big picture, sometimes a plan, if you're being really esoteric about it. And we get great coverage. We've had fantastic coverage. We get double-page spreads of awards in full colour. It's just because we're making the journalists' lives easy for them. I think it's crucially important to do it, to emphasise it, preferably to have somebody in-house, but the RSUA, I think there's a difficulty about scale there. We're lucky that we've got the scale that we can have those resources in-house. to do it, if you like, at a reasonably professional level. And I, you know, it's also fortunate that I know a bit about it. So that helps in the process. It's crucially important. You've got to do it. Because what you're trying to do is raise the profile, not of the RIS, again, I emphasise, but of architecture and architects as the people who make buildings happen, who make places happen.
And that's many audiences, depending on who you're wanting to speak to. And also a national and a local level, you know, because there might be different messages. And one of the things that Neil said was that it is an incorporation of the chapters. And the six chapters are useful from that point of view in terms of feeding through awards and so on. And depending on how vibrant they are at a given point in time, they are very good at the local level in terms of doorstepping the local politicians, the local journalists, getting local exhibitions, etc., etc.
I understand a little bit of the reason for the kind of symposium, but in a number of behaviours, there's a lot of kind of defaulting to the institutes. Actually, I know there's a lot of representation, but our WikiHouse... Our WikiHouse proposal got 80,000 hits on a website in one day. Actually, you can grapple with the things, take responsibility. I think there is a role for the kind of the sort of promotion at a political level, at an international level, but things like local press. Actually, we're in an unprecedented age where if you want to go and make yourself a record and release it on the world, you can. I think we've got new mechanisms, and especially this thing about the majority of people here are sort of, based on the statistics, are going into practices between 1 and 3. Well, now you've actually got autonomy. Simon and I had a little bit of discussion earlier, I think it was, about are we just conservative as a sort of profession? Is it that we're not really entrepreneurial, we're not really risk-taking? Our office is taking some pretty terrifying risks, and yes, it could all end in tears, but we're motivated to take them. We think they've got to be taken, and we have very little contact with the RIBA, and the caveat is be very cautious about the messages that your institution is pushing out, because it's not necessary that they're the right ones, and if they're not, they might not be helping you. So in today, there's quite a lot of none of us are telling you the future. Actually, you've got to define it, and just like Neil's diagram, you tell these guys. Actually, it's not their letter saying this is how it's going to be and these are our committees and that is. No, you're the constituency. You are the membership. It's your profession. Feedback in and either get them to change or do it yourself. I think there needs to be a bit more rather than... Same with public funding. Yeah, yes. We did a case study of 100 projects. None of them sought public funding. And we know the strained times we're in. There's austerity. So actually... There's going to have to be a kind of, right, well, we've just got to do it, and we're going to have to take risks, which is one of those characteristics. We're going to have to take responsibility. We've got to be entrepreneurial. We've got to find different ways. It's very dangerous to sit and just think it's an issue of government, or it's an issue of public funds, or it's an issue of kind of institution. Say our last bit of heresy, perhaps you could worry less about that and just say, well, it's a bit about what we can as individuals just get out there and do. We, for once, did a project 2 weeks ago where I said, this is a project without drawings. Actually, we're just going to go and do something in a space, a fit-out, the cheapest fit-out we've ever done. It's nothing great, but actually the reward people got of being able to realise they didn't need to do a drawing, write a specification, get a contractor to do it and argue about it and the cost at the end of the day. They picked up a can of paint and painted a place. And so a lot of this, actually, I'd advocate a bit more kind of self-determined. Let's do it, just get out there and... and also tell these guys, well, these are the messages.
But I think these guys have been pretty much telling the membership for many years to get up off your arses and do that, pretty much. And it's not getting through, so maybe that's the crucial thing. It's as if architects are waiting for permission to do something like that, and it shouldn't be the case, because we just sort of we're in the position of supporting architects, not representing them necessarily, but supporting them and giving them services. So that message has always been there, you know, and I don't think anyway, as I was saying before, I don't think that architects can lead a discussion on built environment unless they actually come out and have opinions and say what they think about things and not be waiting for other people to do it for them.
Just, yeah. I'm an non-PR, and I think it does very critically need to be about the message. The message that's going out in all that PR, those glossy pictures, is that architects do pretty pictures. We do pretty buildings, and that is the only value we add.
Bollocks.
It's obviously not true, but that is how most practices push themselves out in the world. It's how the award system largely works. And if we are going to actually carve out a decent future, for all of you particularly, most of us can be fine, you've got to change the message.
I'm all right, Jack, was that message.
My practice will carry on long enough to see me to retirement. But the message needs to be that architects offer social value. And we are creative people that solve problems. We don't necessarily just produce attractive-looking things. We have been attacked heavily by politicians in the last couple of years for only producing pretty things. And they haven't got the message, and that is partly our fault as a profession for liking to use delightful, attractive, beautiful pictures of what we do after they've been completed as our main means of communication.
Peter, and then they...
Sorry, heaven forfend that we should persuade the public that we create delight or that you create delight. It's absolutely crucial to the future of architecture that you impress upon the public that that's the business that you're in. And the corollary to that delight is about creating buildings that improve people's lives. That's what the messages are about, and that's what all our messages are about constantly. The other crucial thing, who do people imagine the institutes are? The institutes are the members. They're not me, I'm simply an employee. They are the members who own the organisation. We have, at the beginning of that whole presentation, federal governance. Every member of the incorporation has an input at local chapter level, at national level. The reason for that spread of committees is not because I like writing minutes. It's actually so that we can get everything feeding in and so that the decisions that come out at the end are a sensible distillation of the views of the profession at a given point. And the whole of that presentation was about what the Scottish architectural profession wants its organisation to be doing at this moment to promote its interests. And hopefully we are doing that, and we're doing it as best as we can. And, you know, we keep trying to do it better.
Peter, can I just have a quick comment on the skill set? I guess we're talking to the majority of architectural students. Can I ask, for show of hands, those of you who are studying architecture, recognising it's a great thing to study and it offers so many career opportunities, how many of you are actually considering that you want to be an architect? So lots of hands going up. Okay. This man said, oh, Peter's never going to employ me after what I'm going to say. I would tell you, if one of my clients had a problem or a challenge that his skill set matched up, he would get the phone call within 5 minutes and I'd make sure he was working for us and no one else. And it's what your skill set is. We as contractors, we have to do so much more than just put a building together. We're asked to interview how many local SMEs, how many local supply chain members will you offer? How many apprenticeships will you offer? What business can you help generate in my community? It's far more than just putting bricks and mortar together, isn't it? Yep. And there's the same with architects. I employ a lot of architects, a lot of engineers, and they come into the office for an interview. Hi, I'm an architect. Can you employ me, please? Well, so are so many thousand other architects. What differentiates them? That they have an interest in low energy and what the building is going to perform like in 10 years. Big tick in the box. That are interested in a local community. They're interested in the values and people. Tick in the box. Design also, big tick in the box. So what I'm saying is it's a broad range of skill sets that we have to convince our clients that we are the people to employ. Thank you very much. We have a question here.
Good afternoon, Madam and Sirs. So first of all, thank you for the lecture. I learned a lot from it. And I have a question to Brandon. Yeah, so if there's an international project, for example, in China, so will you consider to keep or use a local traditional features to design project, or what's the first thing you will consider about an international project? Thank you.
Well, the funny thing about Chinese clients is that there's great cachet in China to use American or European architects. And it's the same in Moscow. The Russians love British architects above American and most of the European architects. And they're not interested in the local context or recreating local typologies. They want Western-style architecture. And they're buying it in because it doesn't yet exist there. But it will soon, because one of the growing aspects of architecture in China is Chinese architects who've been trained in the UK going back, setting up, and they will be competing with the EDAS and perhaps us as well in the years to come. And there will be a slow retreat, I think, for Western architects back west as Chinese architects take hold.
Any other questions before I ask Mike to summarize? Yes, Mark. Wait for the mic, Mark. Here it comes.
Mark Hackett from Forum Full Turn to Belfast. I suppose in light of a number of recent answers there, I was thinking to myself, and given the show of hands as well, is it time to abolish the RABA Part 3 exam and to actually recognise that it's an anachronism for most architects, and that possibly a sort of work exam when you're 30, 35, if you need that sort of qualification, is a much more appropriate way. And the second part of that would be, would that be a way to deal with the lack of women in the architectural profession? And that is one of the first barriers, because there's so many young architects being abused at the minute in trying to get work experience for work that doesn't exist to get their RABA Part 3. And they see that as a goal, and they see that as something that is a barrier to them getting work. And I think your point is very good. It's the, you know, what can you actually do? You know, I would never employ anyone based on whether they have RABA Part 3. It's just like, what can I say in a portfolio, and what do you say at an interview is much more important. And the RABA is, you know, causing a real problem for that generation in the last 3 or 4 years, and the next 3 or 4 years. And I think that that debate needs to be had. Addressed to a number of people.
Well, certainly our practice, we have a number of people who are described as architectural assistants. They don't have their Part 3 yet, but no doubt they will be working towards that when they choose to. We also employ architects that have the full range of qualifications. I think, though, the wider point from what I was saying earlier on about leading, not following, there is very much a sort of victim culture in the architectural profession, I would suggest. And I think one of the things that we really have to do is actually make our own luck. And I think that's one of the things that David has said quite succinctly today. Go and look for, you know, maybe different types of work. It's not necessarily what you would classically have perceived architecture to be, but you're very firmly an architect. Now, I believe in that, and I think I would take that a step forward, is that historically, since really about the 1960s, the profession has surrendered aspect after aspect of what it does. And I think we just actually have to be much more aggressive and say that we're good at doing what we do, and actually try and be much more assertive and actually grow our role.
If you ask me who's going to be in a better position, someone who's been sort of educated in vitro in a studio for 6 years and comes out with £70,000 or £100,000 worth of debt, or maybe a 16-year-old who went into an office and learnt in an applied manner, I avoid the word apprenticeship, it's sort of somehow patronising, I think a lot of the skills we're advocating are applied skills. They are judgment, They're actually looking at sort of entrepreneurially, opportunistically at the real world. And we, as teachers, we do teaching, find it very difficult to kind of replicate that. The simplicity of a brief is very hard to wrestle with without just pure speculation. So I think there is actually a threshold, and it takes us back to the professionalism. I'd maybe argue for the part three is actually an exam, say, probably, yeah, late 20s, early 30s, where you're recognised as sort of a level-headed professional, but not make some onerous test. It's much more actually, have you achieved? I always thought the Viva in part three is the most interesting part of it all. Actually, whether you've swatted up on sort of regulations in JCT or not, you can always, if it comes up in the career, what do? You go to the drawer, you get out Chappell's book, you read it, you ask a friend. Don't really need to test someone on that. It's a certain sort of professionalism that I think should be the kind of threshold of the ultimate goal. How we get there, part ones and part twos, I think that's getting increasingly debatable. Because if you do come out of university with £70,000, £100,000 worth of debt, independent practice is going to be very difficult. You're going to have to try and pay that off. You will be driven to large corporate practice just to kind of pay off the debt before you get to the age in life where you want a child and buy a house. So it's really going to threaten the nature of our practice, and I think it'll get more and more scrutiny over the next few years.
I'd just like to comment again on part three as well. The RIBA is being a lot more flexible now than it used to be in relation to getting part three. I'm actually mentoring a student at the minute who's not an employee of mine. He actually works for a contractor, and he's doing his part three through a private project that I'm mentoring him on and working for a contractor and writing up his experience working for a contractor in the design and build environment, but he's not doing design for that contractor. And I think that's a great way to get your qualification. But I actually think part three is very important for all sorts of reasons. We give our students pay rises when they get their part three because we recognise that the professional qualification is worth something and that somebody who has made that effort to get their qualification deserves more salary than somebody who hasn't done that. And I don't agree about the contract stuff. I think that's all vitally important. If you're going to work in a practice where you actually deliver buildings, you need to know the contractual environment. You need to know how to talk to clients. You need to have seen the process, and you need to be able to demonstrate that. And I think it's very valuable, and we pay our staff more because they're qualified.
I think the point that David makes, everybody in this room over the age of 35 had the inordinate privilege of a free tertiary education. Everybody in this room over 35, the vast majority of them will have gone through that education being given a grant. That's all changed. I think the difficulty is with all education now, we're actually getting to the stage that tertiary education will be confined to the elite who can actually either afford it or accept the burden of the debt, knowing with the confidence that they've got the backup, whether it be parental or sheer bloody nerve, that they are going to be able to pay off a debt during their professional careers. And actually, that works against quite a lot of people in our society who won't be easy about the prospect of racking up a huge debt for whatever form of professional training they're going into. So, I mean, I am extremely concerned about the way we are drifting educationally in this country, and it's been very, very rapid. The change has really occurred within the last decade, mainly within the last 5 years, that all of a sudden the barriers come down. You've got a totally different paradigm of tertiary education. You've got an expectation that over 50% of people will be going through tertiary education, and your thesis might be correct, that actually there is absolutely nothing wrong with saying that there should be a stream of people who don't go through that sort of educational process, and you narrow down the sort of tertiary routes. And I'm not being elitist, I'm just saying that within, you know, any meritocratic society, people will decide to do different things. My late father had a diploma. He was really proud of his diploma. His diploma enabled him to be a school teacher. That was absolutely fine. All of a sudden, and he objected to the notion that having his diploma in art, it was devalued because you now had to have a degree in art. And it's this sort of artificial modification that does genuinely give people degrees in David Beckham studies and imagines that those are equal to degrees in medicine, law, accountancy, you know, whatever other professional sphere. It's a complete bloody nonsense. We've created an idiotic educational field.
On that note, I'm conscious of time. We have to be out of here by 6:30, along with all our coffee cups and our so thank you very much.
Can I make one final point? You will note on this crest the words Opera Nostrarum Manuum Dirige. If we all live by that, we'll be fine.
Thank you to the panel. Michael.
Thank you.